It's Sparks from RadioFX. Single chip microcontroller upgrades control functions. Multiple remote control systems now have sophisticated features. By efficient coding, an update module has been designed which uses a microcontroller to retrofit the latest facilities. Few applications have the constraints of size and weight so tightly imposed on them as the remote management system, RMS, developed by onboard consultants. By careful selection of a single-chip microcontroller, a complete onboard computer system for model aircraft has been designed, which performs signal processing to provide fail-safe operation in flight, as well as providing a host of control, trim, and setup features not usually available on radio control equipment in the hobby market. The whole system is built on a PCB measuring only 35 by 59 millimetres, housed in an enclosure no larger than a typical receiver, including the connectors, to allow it to be plugged straight into existing multi-channel control systems. The majority of radio control systems in the hobby market are of the so-called digital proportional type. Newer PCM types are available, but although these provide some advantages of reliability and immunity to interference, they also tend to be much more expensive. The RMS was developed to add interference immunity, similar to that of a PCM system, to a proportional system at an affordable cost, this being thought to be under £100. This has been achieved by adding microprocessor-based signal processing to the receiver. In a typical radio control system, the control signals sent by the transmitter consist of a start pulse, followed by a series of pulses whose spacing is proportional to the control position required on each channel, hence the name. Despite the name, the system is not digital, in that the information is transmitted as an analog variable, the pulse width. At the receiver, the serial string of pulses is separated and fed to the individual servos, which have amplifiers taking the pulse width as a direct set point input. The skill of the model maker is called on to construct and adjust the mechanical linkages to convert this movement into the desired amount of control. Again, various degrees of midpoint and slew rate adjustment are available at the transmitter, depending on the system's price range. The objective of the RMS design being to add a full range of facilities to a basic system. The most expensive systems currently allow the configuration for a number of models to be stored and selected instantly. The added value lies in the fact that these adjustments can be quite critical and very time-consuming on the flying field, where other users may be queuing to use the same RF channel. The RMS can bias or limit individual outputs, store three complete setups in non-volatile memory, including direction, rate and channel coupling or mixing information. Also stored is a set of fail-safe settings for each setup, and a further feature is the ability to adjust engine control at the model for tuning or warm-up with the transmitter off. This could almost justify the device in itself, as adjustment of temperamental two-stroke motors is a notoriously time-consuming part of the modeler's activities. From a signal processing point of view, the system has three stages. First, a signal value for each channel must be extracted from the outputs available at the receiver. Second, adjustments to this value must be made according to the stored information regarding offset limits, that's scaling. Finally, outputs must be sent to each servo corresponding to these results. The choice of microprocessor was made on the basis of its processing power and on-chip features relevant to the system. The Hitachi's H8300 family of single-chip microcomputers, although nominally 8-bit devices, have a number of 16-bit registers and facilities. The architecture is based on general-purpose registers, each of which can function as an accumulator, index register, address pointer, or as local high-speed storage. As a result, very efficient compilers can be written for the H8, and in fact all the code for the RMS was written in C. The particular device used in the RMS is in an 80-pin surface mount flat pack. This was chosen largely because of its on-chip features, its ability to perform the 16-bit input capture. Coupled to the on-chip 16-bit free-running timer are two outputs and another analog input, and provide the user with an indication on the control panel LED of the battery condition. The RMS itself uses only around 20 milliamps, a voltage doubler and regulator ensuring a stable 5 volts. Even when the model is not flying, the H8 earns its keep. If no control signals have been received after a timeout period, the system is programmed to emit a warning beep every 30 seconds until turned off, or until control movements are detected. In the unfortunate event that the model is lost, for example in a tree or cornfield, where it cannot be seen, operating and holding two controls to their full extent will trigger an alarm condition of a series of very loud tones from the speaker. All the beeps and tones used by the system to indicate status and provide warnings are generated by an on-chip 8-bit timer, with their frequencies chosen to be distinctive and clearly audible. Software development was carried out almost exclusively in C. The system has now entered production and has also met its price target. It sells for $84.95. Onboard consultants are based in Twickenham. That article was from Electronic Product Design.
Lots of fun, barefoot and high. The Menace of CD Piracy. A complex network of companies in at least 8 countries juggle copyright laws and turn out illegal CDs in fringe factories run by entrepreneurs from outside the music industry. David Lang reports in Music Business International. Piracy of recordings is fundamentally a legal matter. It occurs when copyright protection is non-existent or when enforcement is inadequate. But the level of piracy is also affected by the availability of pirate-friendly technology. The trade in illegal sound carriers only became seriously damaging for the music industry in the 1960s. The reason was the availability of a cheap format for reproduction and one that was simple to operate, the compact cassette. Previously, the record business had relied on disc pressing, a skilled job and one which was costly to invest in. In the last 25 years, the amount of cassette-borne piracy has grown exponentially. The latest figures, compiled by the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, cover 1989. In that year, over 477 million illegal units were produced worldwide, the majority of them in Southeast Asia. This is equivalent to 20% of the legitimate music market. When compact disc was introduced in 1983, one of its advantages was seen to be its resistance to piracy. Here was a high-technology industry requiring large-scale financial investment and a highly skilled management to high standards of quality control by the companies administering and licensing the patents on which CD manufacturing was based. Now, the record industry is issuing the storm warnings. The number of illegal CDs reaching the marketplace throughout the world has reached alarming levels and is still increasing. In the United States, only 100 illegal CDs were seized during 1988. In the first half of 1990, this had risen to 93,000. And the United States has one of the smaller piracy problems. In his London office, Ian Haffey, Anti-Piracy Coordinator for International Trade Body IFPI, has a shelf full of pirate CDs. Among the prime exhibits are a Best of Madonna disc on a label called Stiff, not the famous UK punk mark, whose bogus address turns out to be that of the United States Embassy in Singapore. Next to that is the Stones in the Park, manufactured in Eastern Europe. This turns out to be the soundtrack of a 1969 UK television programme, shot at a famous Rolling Stones free concert, given shortly after the death of group member Brian Jones. No legitimate recording of the event has ever been released. The cost of CD piracy is difficult to estimate. Haffey says that in 5 countries alone, United States, Canada, Germany, Austria and the UK, illicit copies to the value of $75 million were seized in 1989. But the main geographical sources are clear. The bulk of pirate CDs are manufactured in Southeast Asia and in Eastern Europe. The main Asian culprits are companies operating in Korea and Taiwan. Although both countries have recently improved copyright protection, enforcement is in its infancy. Korea has 2 CD factories in operation, with 3 more due to open by the end of 1991. Music industry sources say that after one US-born managing director of a plant queried an order, suspecting it to be for a pirate product, he was sacked. With 4 CD plants, Taiwan is more worrying, says Ian Haffey. He adds that one investigator employed by the legitimate music industry has already been beaten up and seriously injured. Taiwan was the source of the Madonna Greatest Hits disc. Eastern Europe has been described by Warner Music International chairman Ramon Lopez as a third world territory in the heart of Europe. He was referring to the dangerous lack of copyright protection in the former communist states and their potential for destabilizing markets in Western and Northern Europe by flooding them with cut-price illegitimate products. While some countries, notably Hungary and Poland, are prioritising legal reforms, Lopez's gloomy analysis is also being proved correct. At least four CD plants are operating in Eastern Europe, and last year, unauthorised compact discs by Pink Floyd were discovered in Czechoslovakia, and a Pet Shop Boys CD was on sale in Poland. In Bulgaria, the CD factory is a former weapons factory in Stara Zagora, 400 kilometres from the capital, Sofia. Record industry investigators have yet to visit it. Compact disc was supposed to be the pirate-proof format, but CD bootlegs, counterfeits and pirate copies are on the increase. So what went wrong? There, it seems, are a number of causes. The first is simple ignorance of copyright systems by many of the operators of the 108 CD factories now running throughout the world. These people were entrepreneurs from backgrounds in industry outside the music business, and so were easy prey for pirates looking for custom pressing of material for which they did not own rights. The Recording Industry Association of America has led the way in providing educational programs for CD manufacturers. Its seminars point out indicators that orders and customers could be suspect. These range from the use of post office box numbers as addresses to the placing of orders for small runs by famous artists to making payments in cash rather than by check. According to the RIAA's Dolly Ensie, the persistent failure of a CD manufacturer to turn away orders for pirate product can lead to action by the record industry. A second reason for the ease with which pirates can get access to CD technology is the proliferation of suppliers of the relatively low-cost monoline systems used in the most modern plants. Although Philips maintains overall control of CD manufacturing patents, there are now seven companies making monoline systems. Without their cooperation, organisations like IFPI cannot easily keep track of whose hands CD technology has fallen into. As a result, some well-established twilight operators on the fringes of the European record industry have gained a foothold in the CD market. For two decades, a complex network of companies in at least eight countries, Portugal, Netherlands, Germany, UK, Switzerland, Italy, Denmark and Liechtenstein, have juggled with differing copyright laws and dubious licensing agreements in order to defraud copyright owners of millions of dollars. Several recent prosecutions in Germany, Netherlands, the UK and France have damaged the network, but not fatally. Now, the lack of central control over the licensing of CD technology has enabled the pirates to get access to at least two sources of manufacture. One in Portugal has an annual capacity of 3 million units in a home market of only 0.5 million. The record industry's fight back has had greatest success in the United States, where a combination of vigilant customs control over imports and the RIAA's campaigning has enabled the country to make itself a little island, according to Ian Haffey. Elsewhere, the IFPI has developed a system for discovering the source of manufacture of pirate CDs by examining the physical characteristics of a disc. This can help trace pirate product once it is on the market. But Haffey believes the long-term answer lies in much greater cooperation between all those involved in the CD business. These include the patent licensor, Philips, which is entitled to collect some 3 cents per disc manufactured, equipment suppliers, manufacturers themselves, authors' societies, which have to license the music used on every CD, and distributors, importers and retailers. Of all these, Philips, the custodian of CD technology, could have the most important part to play. However, its critics in the record industry say that the company has now lost control of the situation and no longer even knows how many CD plants are in operation in the world. They charge that CD has given up trying to collect royalties on all discs, and that the company refuses to take past pirate activity into account when granting a license to manufacture. In reply, the company says that European law forbids it to discriminate in this way. Record industry legal experts dispute this, arguing that Section 86 of the Rome Treaty could permit Philips to deny certain companies licenses. IFPI retains a diplomatic silence on this argument, although Ian Haffey believes that the hardware manufacturer will have a crucial role to play in preventing widespread piracy of the new digital compact cassette format, soon to be released by Philips. Are we going to learn from the mistakes made with CD? He asks. Will Philips take on board the difficulties experienced by the record industry when determining its commercial policies in relation to digital compact cassette? That piece by Dave Lang about CD piracy from Music Business International.
Sparks from Radiofax, 6205 and 12255. And here's a piece about independent television.
A piece about commercial television franchises in Britain. Never mind the quality. From the Observer Business News, Emily Bell reports. The Independent Television Commission has set itself a Herculean task. It will decide how the current ITV network will look from 1993, arbitrating on ownership of franchises and types of programming. The ITC's trump card to prevent those with the largest wallets from making a clean sweep at the franchise auction is the magic quality threshold. Designed to protect the nation from poor television, the quality barrier is a sign that although the new Channel 3 network will have to make its own way in a commercial world, full-blown deregulation is not here yet. Cheap and tawdry game shows, witless weather presenters, hours of Antipodean soaps, repeats stretching back to the 1970s, unfunny sitcoms, this is the kind of programming the ITC hopes to weed out, though it looks on paper remarkably similar to a typical day's viewing on the current network. The quality threshold is the hurdle all applicants for a Channel 3 franchise must clear if their bids are to stand a chance. The ITC is combing all 40 franchise applications submitted last month for telltale signs of low-grade programming. Last week, the deadline passed for members of the public to make their views known on the various applications. And by late July, the ITC should have a clear picture of who has passed and failed the quality test. Such is the predominance of the quality factor in discussions that one has to remind oneself that it is commercial television and not the BBC that is under scrutiny. Although commercial TV is driven by advertising revenue, the stampede to quality has arguably seen the requirements of the advertiser relegated, if not disregarded. Quality and commercialism are not mutually exclusive. Indeed, most media buyers would contend that they are interdependent. But have the Channel 3 bidders given enough thought to what the advertisers actually want? And have they allowed for the increased competition in British television that will eat away at proportional advertising revenue over the next 10 years? For an advertiser, quality television delivers audiences. At the moment, the ITV network accounts for 43% of all television viewing, with a further 9% coming from Channel 4. If, after 1993, when the franchises are awarded, that share of the total audience drops, advertisers will be chasing a more fragmented audience, which will mean having to buy more slots to reach the same number of viewers. Competition in television will only intensify the battle for audiences. Satellite has yet to make an impact on advertiser budgets, but media directors think it is only a matter of time. Adam Stanhope of Initiative Media believes the signs are already there. Take the TVAM franchise, for example. Where homes have B Sky B, it is taking up to a 60% share of audience at certain times. That is a potentially massive problem for that franchise, and a clear example of where advertising revenue could drop away. Stanhope says he would question whether in all cases potential bidders have properly addressed the issue of commerciality. So far, the focus has been on winning a franchise, which means satisfying the ITC on quality, but dialogue on the issue of continuing advertiser support has been missing. The franchise bidders have been lobbying media buyers for their views on the commercial viability of their programming. One or two, such as Thames and Granada, have invited comment from advertisers and their representatives, while other consortia have canvassed opinion anonymously through consultants. J. Walter Thompson's joint media director, Dominic Proctor, says he would find it astounding if bidders had not bothered to research their proposals thoroughly with advertisers and buyers, but admits that there are hidden rocks for franchisees to flounder on. I think most applicants will have erred on the side of caution, and rightly so. The 10-year franchise period we are talking about will contain a number of unknown quantities. Channel 5 is planned to come on air. The BBC could well be carrying advertising, and satellite will be an increasing factor. The unknown quantities make it impossible for any forecaster to predict accurately what a franchise might be worth for the full duration of the license. The ITC is also examining the quality of bidders' business plans to ensure that revenue projections can be met through the planned programming, though some buyers doubt whether the ITC's view of quality television will necessarily square with advertisers' needs. Mike Gorman, media director at DMB&B's media unit, which buys some £175 million of television media per year, is one such sceptic. There is a case for saying quality should be measured on audiences. The ITC's view of quality errs towards the esoteric and erudite. But programming that attracts audiences does not necessarily have to be game shows appealing to the lowest common denominator. A well-balanced diet is needed. Getting assorted media directors to nominate their favourite candidates for the franchise auction is, as one put it, horribly political. But most found broad agreement in one or two regions. Of the newcomers, the strongest are perceived to be Carlton and the MAI-backed Meridian Television. Carlton shows every sign of being able not only to replace Thames, but to supersede it, commented one. The appeal of Meridian, whose bid is firmly based on high-grade programming, is a sign that advertising is not necessarily the enemy of quality. It is felt that if a non-incumbent succeeds on the exceptional circumstance clause that allows the ITC to hand the franchise to a lower bidder, Meridian may well swing the Southern Television franchise away from TVS. That article by Emily Bell in The Observer.